I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Senator Bernie Sanders is holding campaign rallies in Kansas tomorrow. We'll be talking with him this hour. But first, employment and education opportunities have drawn many citizens of India to the metro over the years. They live in neighborhoods and towns and dorms throughout the area. But violence has killed or injured several Indian nationals in the last 2 years. So we begin today by asking how those living here and people back home in India have come to view Kansas City. Then we'll hear about how new technology, including holograms, is teaching local medical students. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. This has been a tough couple of years for Kansas Cityans whose heritage or home is the country of India. In 2017, Srinivas Kushibotla was killed and Alok Madasani was injured when a man shot them at an Olathe restaurant yelling, "Get out of my country." Indians and Indian Americans, like other people of color in the metro, routinely report discrimination in their day-to-day lives. Some have expressed fear about how the changing landscape of immigration law could affect them. Then, of course, earlier this month, Sharath Kopu, a UMKC student from India, was shot and killed while he worked at a restaurant on Prospect, not far from campus. While there was no indication that his nationality was a factor in his killing, Kopu's death was a painful exclamation point on the risks of living and working in a city far from home. All of this had us wondering, how is the Indian community doing in the metro? And back in India, what do people think of Kansas City? Are we getting a reputation as a place that's unwelcoming or even dangerous? Joining us this morning are Ravi Anand Naidu. He's in charge of hospitality for the UMKC Indian Students Association. Ravi, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thank you.
Rajiv Bansal is Vice President of the India Association of Kansas City Board. And Rajiv, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Brian, for inviting us.
And Dean Kevin Truman of the UMKC School of Computing and Engineering joins us as well. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Brian.
Ravi, first of all, my condolences to you and to your fellow students at the loss of your classmate and friend.
It's a very unfortunate situation which happened, and we're coping through it.
I'm sure it's very difficult. How are people doing? How have you? I know a group of students gathered last week.
That's right. So Saturday we had a gathering. We organized a gathering for all the people, and so in the meeting we asked the people to talk something about Sharath or share their memories, so that when they talk, at least their grief is shared. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the people are doing okay, I guess. It'll take time to cope with something like this because it's your fellow student. You will miss him in your classes. And for the people who are his classmates, they'll definitely miss him. But I think they will cope through it, yeah.
Ravi, tell me about you. How long have you been here in Kansas City?
I've been here for 1 year, 7 months. I started school in spring 17, Jan 17. And it's been 1 year, 7 months since here.
Where in India are you from?
I'm from Hyderabad, Telangana, India.
All right. For those who don't know the geography of India very well, where is that?
It is the southern part of, it's South India.
Okay. Yeah. And why did you come to Kansas City to come to school in the first place?
So I had looked at other options too, but UMKC, I have read about Kansas City. So I'm an electrical engineering student, and I read that there are good opportunities for a job and good research opportunities in UMKC and the surrounding greater Kansas City area and the areas nearby. So I thought it'll be a good choice, UMKC. So that's how I chose UMKC.
Well, your dean is sitting here next to you, Dean Truman. It's not an accident or a coincidence that there is a significant Indian presence at UMKC, is it?
No. Many of the Indian students are looking for that opportunity to get a U.S. education, which is still considered to be a gold standard. In addition to that, Kansas City is rich in engineering and computing opportunities. We can't supply enough domestic students, and so it gives an opportunity for many of the international students to come here and do what we call practical training, and then possibly secure a job in the future.
I understand you've actually traveled to India to represent the university.
I've been to India probably 6 or 7 times in the last 4 years. Probably will make 2 trips there this year as well.
And when you talk with folks about UMKC, about Kansas City, what do they say? What do you hear?
You know, most of the time when we're talking about Kansas City, it is about the opportunities. It's about the jobs. But we do spend a great deal of time talking about the number of families in Kansas City that can support those students outside the university. And I'm sure you'll hear more about that in a few minutes. But we talk about, first of all, the disciplines, which are computer science and electrical engineering, are 2 of the hottest topics or areas for jobs, both in India and in the United States. And so that is the real opportunity and what they want. We also believe that on the UMKC campus that we want to have cultural diversity. So we work very hard to get an international population. We talk a lot about India, but in the School of Computing Engineering, we have 30 different countries represented.
Yeah.
And this has a great deal to do with moving us forward as a university.
And we should mention that UMKC is, KCUR is an editorially independent community service of UMKC. Rajiv Bansal, I want to ask you about the many families that Dean Truman mentioned. How many Indian nationals are living here in the Kansas City area? Is it a bigger number than people may realize?
So, in fact, when we came here, it was way back in 2000. That time, there were just about probably 3,000 to 3,500 families in the greater Kansas City area. If you look at last year, it's almost in excess of about 8,000 families. So you can see that greater Kansas City has been the home of a lot of people coming in here, primarily because the Midwest, as we know, is conservative in its approach. So it's very good for raising family. And that's one of the reasons. Education, family life, and work-life balance is one of the best in the United States out here.
And, you know, so you're talking about families coming here specifically because of some of what Kansas City has to offer, and yet the last couple of years have had some difficult incidents that Indian nationals in particular seem to have experienced. Has that affected the community?
It has affected the community in terms of, like, what has happened, which was unfortunate. But as we say, life goes on. Yes, we share the grief. But at the end of the day, you know, some of these incidents happen because probably education about what Indians are or what people are across the borders from the United States is not proper. And that's why we partner with the various government agencies to ensure that we are part of the community. And you can see many initiatives which are happening in this regard.
You know, I wonder, Rajiv, various immigrant communities from other countries as well have said that they feel like the last 2 years since President Trump took office have presented a different set of challenges, a different environment for immigrant communities. Has that been your experience?
I would not say anything of that sort at this moment, at this juncture, because I believe that, you know, if you're a rightful immigrant, I haven't seen anybody having that kind of an issue. It could be my personal observation, but I have not seen anything which is detrimental to that effect. So,
that's Rajiv Bansal. He's vice president of the India Association of Kansas City. We're also talking today here on KCUR's Up to Date with Ravi Anandanaidu from UMKC, a student, and Kevin Truman, the dean of the UMKC School of Computer and Computing and Engineering. I want to invite our listeners to be part of this conversation, too. If you're part of Kansas City's Indian community, we would love to hear from you. You can call us at 816-235-2888. How has it been living and working or studying here in Kansas City? How has it changed in the last couple of years? Share your story and your views. Call us at 816-235-2888. I'm curious, Ravi, have you thought at all in these in this time of grief and the things that have happened about leaving Kansas City?
That thought has not crossed my mind yet. But so I think I've always been in the safe places right from January because right when I applied to UMKC and I did a research on the Kansas City, I know I came to know that, okay, Kansas City might not be a really safe place because it's the age of internet. You get to see all the crimes that are being there mm-hmm. every day. So right from January when I stepped foot into the U.S., I was like, let's try to avoid areas which are not really safe and let's try to be there. Because now I'm in UMKC and I graduate almost December because Kansas City what I realized is not all a bad place. There are good places and it has good opportunities. So just try to avoid bad places. And I'm sure every city in the U.S. has such places where it's not safe to go. So, and just be aware of the safe places. That's fine.
Right, which would be true in any city. I mean, do you when you talk to your family back home, are they concerned about your safety or about you being in Kansas City in particular? Do they distinguish between Kansas City and other places in the country?
My mom is worried every day because she came to know even when I came before. Like, I started school at UMKC, you know, so I told her that Kansas City is so-and-so because you have to tell your parents about the city. Mm-hmm. And she calls me up every day, she tells me, if the classes in the morning, go off in the afternoon or go in the evening, don't be out till late in the dark in the night, go back home. And she's always checking on me every day. There's not been a single day that I've not got a phone call from her asking her if you're safe, so...
Yeah. Dean Truman, I wonder if in your efforts to recruit students and stay in touch with the contacts you have in India, has anything over the last 2 years made your job more difficult?
Well, definitely those two incidents have made my job more difficult. Also, the current rhetoric with the administration in the U.S. right now, many of the students that we're recruiting, as I said, are looking for job opportunities, and they're afraid that H-1B visas and job opportunities might dwindle under this administration.
Hmm.
But it's really interesting. Just a reflection, when I go to India to recruit, it's oftentimes the parents are there, and they want to hear about the safety. They want to hear about how their children are going to live in the United States.
They're not just wanting their children to get an American degree at any cost. They really do care about where they are and what that place is like.
Absolutely. So we spend a great deal of time talking about Kansas City and how to live in a city in the United States.
I'm curious, Rajiv, how long has your family been in the United States?
So as I said, we came to the U.S. I came in 1998, so it's been 20 years. We came to Connecticut, the East Coast, and then after 2 years there, I was transferred to Kansas City. And it was anecdotal that people said, like, are you going to Kansas City? Good luck. It's like, why? Oh, it's right in the Midwest. Like, no, nothing moves out there. They say, it's the city of CNT. I said, like, what's CNT? They said, cows, corn, tornadoes, thunderstorms. So my wife and kids were like, no, we don't want to go there. So I said, okay, I'll go there, check it out. I came here. Yes, the very first day I saw all four seasons in one day, which is, I think, typical out here.
Sure.
But then I realized that this place was much better than what it was labeled as. You know, it's conservative in nature, so family atmosphere. People are helpful. And coming to safety, I would say, look at downtown Kansas City, where, like, before 2004, people would not venture out. Today, it's the most humming place out here with the Kansas City Power and Light District. I used to work for H&R Block for 10 years, and we are the first ones out to start the whole, Power and Light District regeneration.
Yeah.
So I would say, it's been a good experience, and we have stayed here for 18 years now, and I don't think so we plan to move from here at the moment.
Have you ever experienced discrimination overtly here or even not so overtly?
I wouldn't say discrimination. People generally, people are curious when you go, because the color of your skin being brown, people ask you, where are you from? I say, from India. Oh, so you're not from such and such country or whatever. And so, once they get to know it, there's a lot of inclusiveness. I can say that.
I am struck by the fact about the incident back in 2017 in Olathe. Prosecutors said it was a hate crime, but the perpetrator didn't correctly identify the race of his victims. He thought they were Middle Eastern. I guess I'm curious from you, Ravi. Have you experienced discrimination, and is it specifically because you're from India?
So I'd like to echo with Rajiv here, because the skin of your color is brown, and people, they ask you questions, where are you from? And okay, so, and then you tell them about India, they're fascinated. Oh, you're so from here and there. So I would not call it discrimination, but they are curious to know about you because you look different.
And it doesn't really, they don't know what country you're from. They just know you look different.
Yes.
Are there any particular challenges in either of your experiences that Indian Americans in Kansas City face that are different from what other immigrant communities or other people of color face?
So you're different here. It's going to take some time for you to adjust to adjust to the culture, to the people here. I think that will be a challenge, but when you try to understand the people here and once they try to understand what you're all about, and then I think that is not a challenge anymore, and that gap is bridged over there. So that would be the most challenge, to understand the country, to understand how people work, because, you know, every country is different as a matter of rates, you know, so you just have to know about the city, know about the place, know about the people. Yeah.
Dean Truman, with the close connection that the university has tried to forge with students from India, I'm curious if the university is taking particular steps in response to some of what's happened over the last couple of years.
Absolutely. We, first of all, are trying to interact with the students on at a greater level and to make sure that they are being taken care of through this grieving period. We have counseling services and everything else. But at the same time, we're trying to educate them about safety, about Kansas City and the right places to be. In addition to that, we are reaching out to India. We have many partners, institutions and universities there to have a very positive message going forward to the staff and students of those institutions. I will probably make a quick trip over to talk to those institutions in the fall semester just to reassure them just the things that we've been talking about today.
One of the real differences I know between a lot of American culture and Indian culture is this, what is sometimes called the gun culture of the United States, and particularly certain parts of it, including the Midwest. I'm curious, Ravi, how did that take some getting used to, just the prevalence of guns in America?
It did, I don't think I really got used to it, because it's always there on my mind, you know, because people are carrying guns around. I'm in UMKC most of the time, and UMKC, you know, has a policy of no guns. But when you go to other shopping malls and movie theaters and other public places, you know, you're always worried, you know, because I have seen people with guns, and, you know, so.
Yeah.
That's a problem.
It kind of startles
you. It's not a usual
scene
it. That you have grown up with. And to be adjusted that in, you know, in 6 or 7 months, it'll I think it's going to take more time. Yeah.
Yeah. I would think that would be, take some getting used to. Similar experience for you, Rashid?
You know, like, it's again, they say the lay of the land defines how you kind of like, you know, act and behave. If you have done nothing wrong, first of all, you don't have to fear anything. I come from a place in India, which, like, I have spent a major part of my life out there, in a place where it's in the North Indian part, where literally ruling by might is right. So I have seen such instances there. But again, like, you know, when you come here, you see, it's like it's a law here. There is not a law. There people would keep it on the side. But again, like I said, if you have not done anything wrong, if you don't interfere with somebody else's day-to-day affairs, and if you don't confront them, I don't think so you have anything to fear.
Although that actually wasn't true of the, unfortunately, the two who have died in the last couple of years.
Exactly. But that's what I said. That's why I said those two were unfortunate incidents. We cannot, you know, predict and prevent. Hmm. But all we can do is try to take proactive measures. And as Ravi said, like, don't go to such places where you feel that there's a possibility of security and life safety. And I think that'll be the first step in this regard. That's where there's a need for education of people who are coming from India out here to, like, how to live and behave in this country.
Well, and how should that education take place? As we think about steps forward, as we think about how the culture and the relationship of Indians with Kansas City's culture can be on the uptick in coming years, how do you think that can happen, Ravi? What needs to happen?
So when the international students, so there's something called as an international student orientation. And, you know, so all the students who come in have to attend that session. And so maybe in that session, you know, insights about Kansas City can be given, like, you know, what to do and what not to do, because you're in a foreign land. It's no more home, but you're in a foreign land. So we have to educate people on these things, about their safety, because their safety, I think, is the priority here. So, yeah, I think that should be done in the orientation sessions, or workshops should be conducted, like, in between semesters, so that, you know, everybody is safe.
And I know that another piece of that education is cultural education. I know that the India Association of Kansas City, Rajiv, holds events all year round, but there's one coming up called the India Fest. What is that?
So India Fest was started in 2012. This is the 7th edition of India Fest. It's basically a fun-filled day, free to the general public. It's not limited to Indians. We generally have people from all walks of life, all nationalities, citizenship, and race, creed, color. And they come in. It starts at 11 o'clock and goes on till 6 o'clock, during which time you are exposed. You can see, you know, the dance. There's a cultural program going on around the clock. There are artifacts which are being sold. There are information booths. There are different cultural presentations about what each state means and what the attire of that state is. There are people who come from different parts of the United States who sell their wares out there.
And there's food.
And there's food, after all. Like the 10 of the top eateries around Greater Kansas City area, even as far as from near the airport, like the couple from Zona Rosa, they also come. They sell their food, and you can savor those for like much lesser cost than what you'd pay on a normal dinner time.
Swagat, Moti Mahal.
Swagat, yeah.
Some of my favorite restaurants.
Touch of fashion, you know. Yeah.
August 26th is when that is. It's at 10 to 6 at the
11 to 6 at the Olin Park Convention Center. And it's free. We have grown from 6,000 people in 2012 to last year it was more than 11,000. So that's why this time the Olin Park Convention Center has opened up the entire top floor instead of, you know, just the three segments.
That's August 26th. There's more information at the website of the India Association. It's iakc.org. Dean Truman, as you look to this year ahead, what should Indian students considering coming to Kansas City know? What should they be thinking about?
Well, I think what they need to be thinking about is, again, connecting with the students in the community in a way that can help them be safe and secure. They still like to get that advice from people that they feel culturally are similar. And so, much like Ravi said, the orientations, we talk about safety, but often we need to do it more often because they're oftentimes just getting off a plane, trying to find a place to live, and maybe those messages aren't settling in. And we need to do that a little bit more frequently.
That's Kevin Truman. He's dean of the UMKC School of Computing and Engineering. We also have been joined today by Ravi Anand Naidu, who is part of the UMKC Indian Students Association, and Rajiv Bansal with the India Association of Kansas City. Thank you all for being here today.
Thank you.
It may not be long before you can go to the doctor and find that he or she learned about your body not by practicing on a patient, but by turning on a computer and calling up a hologram. It's happening here in Kansas City, and we'll hear more about that in just a minute. Stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the program, we talked about what services are available locally for people dealing with mental health issues. You can find out more at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, the love-hate relationship between American and British English. Join us for that conversation tomorrow on Up to Date. Later this hour, we'll talk with Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont about his visit tomorrow to campaign for Kansas congressional candidates. But first, how do doctors learn to be doctors once they get out of the classroom and the textbooks? For a long time, it was pretty straightforward. Medical students went around hospitals with teaching doctors and ultimately practiced those colonoscopies or inserting catheters into an artery on, well, you. But thanks to evolving technology, students in the Kansas City area may soon be sharpening their scalpels to cut into holograms or donning virtual reality glasses to look at brains floating right out in front of them. Joining us to talk about this next frontier in medical education is Dr. Darren D'Agostino, the Executive Dean in the College of Osteopathic Medicine at the Kansas City University of Medicine and Biosciences. They're building a new simulation center. He's here to tell us about it. Dr. Ed D'Agostino, welcome.
Thank you very much, Brian. Great to be here.
And joining us by Skype is Erin Henninger. She's Executive Director of Interactive Commons at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. Dr. Henninger, thank you for being here.
I'm not a doctor.
I've just awarded you an honorary degree. Erin,
I'm a regular patient like everyone else.
Welcome. We're glad you're here.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. D'Agostino, I guess the benefit of training on real people is that at least you know afterward whether you did it right or not. Do I have the process right? Is that kind of the regular standard for medical education?
Well, that was a standard in the past. That pretty much started to go away in the 1990s when we realized we had to do it a little bit differently. We didn't have enough masters out there to teach everybody, so we had to learn a little bit differently. And since that time, we've moved away from practicing on actual patients. We want to make sure when we get there, we're ready to go.
So what have you practiced on instead? I read an article that even the very most respected medical institutions sometimes make little simulations that are out of a couple of plastic tubes and pieces of felt.
Yep, that is one way of doing it. It's actually been shown to help, especially with technical skills, learning how to put a scope in somebody or actually cannulate a vessel. All of these things are very important to learn how to do. So the technology doesn't have to be expensive. It just has to represent the task at hand.
And yet there is some expensive technology out there that might do some new things. Aaron Hanger, you work with an interdisciplinary program there at Case Western that has been developing some new things. Tell us a little bit about the program you're involved with.
Sure. So we were charged with looking at a way of teaching medical anatomy with a digital tool rather than our tradition of cadaver-based dissection. And so when we looked out at the options, we had the privilege of seeing a technology out of Microsoft called Microsoft HoloLens back in 2014 and realized that this gave us a tool that would allow students to look at the human body in full 3D together as a group. So much like we experience our traditional classrooms, we can use this technology to explore the body without having to cut, without making mistakes as we go, that we can get a true systems-level perspective on medical anatomy.
Dr. D'Agostino, one of the big projects in Kansas City that we've been hearing a lot about is the new simulation center that's opening at KCUMB. It's a big project. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this is the Center for Medical Education Innovation. It's a 56,000 square foot building that will really be future-proof and grow our ability to teach using these new technologies and some of the older technologies. Nothing really replaces the face-to-face attention that a faculty member and a student has. We really need to enhance that, and I think a lot of these technologies can bring that to light. This building is going to have a simulation deck to be able to work in surgical ORs or simulated patients and primary care. We're also going to have a hands-on live simulation with patient-based simulation. We have small room teaching that will allow us to work in a virtual world. So a number of different things will be brought into this.
Okay, wait. I need you to unpack some of that for me. There's a simulation deck, so it'll be like a student is in an OR. How mm-hmm. so? Will there be models? Will there be projections? How will you accomplish that?
Yeah. So one of the main things in simulation that has grown over the last few years, really since the 1960s, is using mannequins to represent human physiology. What we're creating there, which is not unlike most other institutions that have produced simulation labs, is an environment that really mirrors what the student is going to go into. But instead of using humans, we will be using mannequins that can represent the physiology and the pathophysiology. So we're developing a deck and an entire floor that's going to be related to these types of procedures. And we can do really everything that could be done in a hospital, in a surgical suite, can be done in this simulated lab.
On a pretend patient.
On a pretend patient.
Aaron, the work you're doing up there at Case Western, you mentioned this this HoloLens program from Microsoft. You're actually experimenting with use of holograms to represent the patient, right?
That's right, yes. So in representing human anatomy, we wanted to show the students the full human body, the ability to isolate particular organ systems and really gain an understanding of those structures and their locations. And this is just the start. So we're starting by showing a healthy male and female middle-aged adult. And from there, we can continue developing on those models to bring in different states of disease. We can add physiology, show how the body moves, make the heart beat, make the lungs breathe, and really bring this virtual patient to life.
When I think of a hologram, though, I think of something that you look at. It may be a really impressive 3D representation, but how do you actually interact with it? How does a medical student learn anything about what it's like to touch or to make an incision in a patient?
Yeah, I think a lot of people expect from the cadaver lab that students are learning how to do a surgery, and that's really not the purpose of our cadaver lab. You know, we're learning about the anatomical structures in that space. And so, you know, the textures of the body, of a preserved body, it's not the same as a living patient. And so as we went on this digital exploration to look for an alternative to cadaver-based dissection, we realized we want to train our students to teach a living human. And so that's not actually what they're learning when they're in the cadaver lab. So in interacting with a hologram, we can provide a more representative visual of a living human, and we can build on that. And the way our curriculum is designed is they'll start with holograms. They'll also do physical diagnosis supported by ultrasound on living bodies so that they're getting that experience and tactile experience. And then they'll also do a radiology component where they're getting exposure to medical images that they'll encounter at the clinical level.
Dr. D'Agostino, I know we're talking about two different things in a way. We're talking about anatomy studies on what used to be done using a cadaver, but we're also talking about learning to practice particular techniques. The new simulation center will also use something called haptic technology. What is that?
We will. We'll have haptic technology linked to some of this virtual reality as well as holographic images as that develops. Haptics are essentially a way of electronically stimulating the user's hands to represent the tactile sensations of what they're doing. So this might be, to answer your question, a holographic image and reaching in to actually test skin turgor or feel the cut of a knife. Now, that technology is only emerging now, so I don't anticipate that's going to be an upfront element in what we're doing, but we certainly want to have the option of adding it in. The anatomy that's been discussed through the HoloLens is a very, very neat tool to teach three-dimensional anatomy and understand things in the normal sense, but you don't get that with a cadaver. With a cadaver, we often get different tissues. We sometimes are limited to what that particular person had, and there may be anomalies. So what we can do is actually control the learning environment with things like HoloLens and HoloAnatomy.
If the cadaver of the person had cancer or didn't have cancer, you aren't able to recreate what that person was not.
Correct. And we can look through different levels of anatomy using the technology to enhance the educational experience.
For those of us who aren't scientists and who don't know this stuff, when we think of virtual reality, we maybe think, Aaron, of virtual reality goggles that you watch a cool video with, or maybe a video games. Is this kind of the same technology, just taking it to the next level, or is this something different?
I would describe it as a different type of medium than virtual reality. So in VR, we're closed off from the world. We're wearing a headset that is very immersive and can be very powerful for simulation, but we're sort of in our own world or transported to a different place. In a medium like HoloLens, this is mixed reality or augmented reality. And so in that environment, we're actually grounded in our world. We see the people around us, we see the furniture in our room, and we're projecting holographic information into that world. So it's very different, and HoloLens allows multiple users to partake in this experience. So you have a shared group environment where we can explore in a very social way and in a way that is very conducive to learning and the type of learning that we traditionally do.
I'm curious, Dr. D'Agostino, does this replace the work that your students will do, spending time on rotations in hospitals and getting that exposure to real people?
So the goal is not to do that. The goal is to enhance that experience. Most of these technologies, what's really neat about them is you don't have to be sitting in a classroom to use them. If it's set up right, you can be anywhere in the United States and use a lot of these technologies. Some of them are resident on a computer and others are working through the cloud. The idea of mixed reality and augmented reality is already being tested in actual surgical suites. It's pretty neat stuff. You put these glasses on and you can actually look at the anatomy. You can actually pull up x-rays. You can watch as you're doing surgery. The different vessels and things that have to that you have to be aware of and control in a surgical environment. And so these should never replace. What they should do is augment and help and enhance. With students, the biggest issue is giving them an opportunity to link information, so that they have it there and know how to use it. It's really about creating aptitude and really about creating an environment where a student is not experimenting for the first time on a human being, but rather reviewing information and moving forward.
I find myself wondering, as both of you are talking, is this really only about medical education? Or, Aaron, do you see that this is also going to change the way care is actually provided? And will physicians and experienced surgeons, will they be using this kind of technology?
Yeah, I think we imagine a world where this would be a wonderful tool for patient education. You know, the idea of the doctor describing what's going on in a medical image that is a two-dimensional sort of gray and white blobs that we're looking at. You know, surgeons and physicians are really good at understanding this data and assembling that 3D picture in their mind, but lay people are not. The average patient is not. And so I think it would be immensely helpful for patients' families to be able to look at this information together with their doctor and really get a clear picture of their health. And then beyond that, even across our campus, you know, there's so many aspects of learning that are going to be touched by this technology. We're currently running pilots in physics and crystal science and even doing things in the dance space. So we're going to see this impact so much of what we're doing today.
I don't understand what you mean. Doing things in the dance space?
Yes, we've actually run a dance performance where dancers were interacting with holographic props. Holograms became part of their costume, and even the set pieces were holographic. We put 80 members of an audience into this holographic headset, the Microsoft HoloLens, and they watched this performance together. So this just touches everything that we're doing.
Darren D'Agostino, you've been doing medical education at KCUMB for a long time. How revolutionary is this kind of change?
Well, medical education has gone through three major changes in the United States over the last couple hundred years. It's been very interesting to watch this develop. We're actually at a place now where medical education is not about what you learn in the classroom, but how you use it. Since information is free and the internet has pretty much everything out there, we have to understand how to pull the information in, but then how to use it. And that's really what's going on here. With these technologies, we now have new tools to actually deliver that ability to teach a student in a way, or at least to produce the five major tasks that we ask them to do while they're in medical school. That is to learn how to diagnose, how to explain a problem, which really gets to physiology and pathology, how to be able to treat a patient, how to be able to manage a patient, and then how to prevent disease. And prevention is really key here because the future of medicine is going to be prevention and population health.
The reality, of course, is that this involves teaching people to work with these simulated situations that are not the real people, but you're trying to train them to work with real people. Do you worry that as technology takes things away from that real patient interaction, that it gets harder to train people how to work with real people?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think what's going to happen here is that the level of simulation and the level of interaction with patients is going to shift a bit. We'll never not bring a student to meet a patient. But what we will do is hold back before they do the first procedure until we know that they are competent and have the capacity to do that. These tools allow us to actually prove that. Instead of learning on that patient for the first time, by the time that student gets there, they're going to know how to do this. And that's really it. We'll never be able to substitute the real person experience.
I want to ask you about the simulation center. $33 million project, 56,000 square feet, maybe the biggest undertaking that KCUMB's ever tried to take on all at once. How's it going? You've broken ground.
It's going great. We have a big hole in our backyard. I get to look at it every day. It's pretty impressive. And in about 16 and a half months, we're going to be walking our current new class into that building and start using these technologies.
And Aaron, is this the kind of thing that's happening in other places around the country? How many schools are taking on projects like you're doing at Case Western and like we're hearing about here in Kansas City?
I think there's a lot of interest around the country and around the world in this technology. So we've been getting a lot of interest in the program we're developing and just in the process of understanding how do we roll this out in a global way. You know, when HoloLens came out of the box in 2015, it didn't have a classroom infrastructure associated with it. It was such a brand new technology. And so we've been developing all of the frameworks that are required and thinking about the pedagogy of, you know, how do we roll this out in an effective classroom? So I think there's so much interest, and we're just getting to the point where this kind of curriculum can be rolled out and be tried and tested. You know, over the last 2 years, we've been piloting it with our students, and our full rollout happens in July of 2019.
And
so I think we're going to see a lot more.
And what has to happen before your project's done, Dr. D'Agostino?
Oh, there are a bunch of steps. Besides the building going up and making sure all the electricity gets to where it has to go, we do have some research we have to do on the technology we want to bring in. There is a lot of competition out there right now. There are a lot of different products to teach anatomy or to teach physiology. I've experimented with a bunch of them, and every one of them has something pretty neat. What we have to do is design the need around what we're teaching in our curriculum.
That's Dr. Darren D'Agostino. He's Executive Dean and also Vice President of Health Affairs at KCUMB. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And Erin Henninger. She joined us by Skype from Cleveland. Erin, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison. Senator Bernie Sanders ran for president in 2016. He fell short of the nomination with the Democratic Party, but his candidacy rallied a progressive movement that has many supporters calling on him to run again in 2020. Meanwhile, he's using his high profile to support other candidates around the country, and he brings his message to Kansas tomorrow, where he'll campaign with two candidates for Congress. Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, joins us by phone now from his office in Washington, D.C. Senator, welcome.
Good to be with you.
So tomorrow evening, you'll be over in Kansas City, Kansas at a rally for Brent Welder. He's one of several Democrats competing to unseat Kevin Yoder in Kansas' 3rd District. Of all the places you could be campaigning, why here in Kansas?
Well, I think we want to make the point, and I know that people say, well, Kansas is a conservative state, why are you going there? And I think the point that we want to make is that the ideas that Brent is talking about, the ideas that I and other progressives are talking about are ideas that really resonate in every single state in this country. I think if you go throughout Kansas and you ask people whether or not we should raise the minimum wage to a living wage, they'll say yes. If you ask the people in Kansas, should we do what every other major country on earth does and guarantee health care to all people as a right? I think they will say yes. Should we rebuild our crumbling infrastructure? Should we make public colleges and universities tuition free? Instead of, as Trump would like to do, giving huge tax breaks to billionaires and profitable corporations, should we, in fact, ask the wealthiest people in this country and the largest corporations to start paying their fair share of taxes?
But,
and you know what? I think the people of Kansas will say yes again.
But Senator, you'll be joined, of course, tomorrow by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She's the 28-year-old who upset Joe Crowley, part of the House Democratic leadership in his primary in the Bronx last month. You both identify as Democratic socialists. I guess for Brent Welder to win the seat, he's going to have to win over a good number of Republicans, at least people who've supported Yoder in the past. Do you think support from progressives like you is really going to help him in the long run, or could it drive away moderate voters?
Well, I think if you get away from labels and you ask people to talk about and think about the issues facing this country, Donald Trump supported a massive tax breaks for the wealthiest people in this country. 83% of the tax benefits of his proposal go to the top 1%. And then Trump introduced a budget supported by many Republicans, which calls for massive cuts to Medicaid, Medicare, and the Social Security Disability Fund. I think that the vast majority of the people in Kansas do not think that that is a good idea. So I believe that if you look at the issues out there, raising the minimum wage, health care for all, pay equity for women, rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure, making public colleges and universities tuition free, you know what? On all of those issues, I think our side has majority support.
Including some of those Republicans who voted for Yoder in the past.
Well, I think also it's not just getting Republicans. That would be good. And I think there are a lot of moderate Republicans in Kansas who are not happy with a president who, among other things, does not have the guts to stand up to Vladimir Putin. But I think it's also a question of not only appealing to Republicans, but of expanding the voter turnout. 4 years ago, you may recall, in America, we had the lowest voter turnout in a midterm election in 70 years. And if you have candidates who are talking about the real issues that impact working people, a lot of folks who have given up on the political process may rethink that and get involved and start voting.
So you of course, aren't a Democrat. If Welder doesn't win the primary, would you support whatever Democrats on the ballot in November? Do you support?
Well, sure. I think it is very important that we end one-party rule right now in Washington. You have a very right-wing Senate. You have a right-wing House, and you have a president who, you know, is proposing cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security disability benefits.
You really did energize quite a movement back in 2016, Senator, especially among younger voters, a lot of them here in Kansas and Missouri. What do you hope is the lasting influence of that campaign? What do you want your supporters to be doing now?
Well, there are two things. I think, number one, what we have seen is a strong, strong growth in the progressive movement in America. Ideas like health care for all, or making public colleges and universities tuition free, or demanding the wealthy start paying their fair share of taxes. Those ideas seemed to be pretty extreme a few years ago, but they're now kind of part of the mainstream. And I think we've got to fight for those ideas. Second of all, in these very difficult times, I think we need to make sure that all Americans are involved in the political process. We should not continue to have the lowest voter turnout of almost any major country on earth. So I think if working people, young people, get involved in the political process, demand that we have a government that represents all of us and not just the Koch brothers and a handful of other billionaires, I think the country will be in better shape.
Turning to one other issue that's going to come up probably this summer for you in the Senate, the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh as a Supreme Court justice. You've obviously talked with a lot of your colleagues about that. Will he get the 51 votes he needs?
That is a good question. I don't think anyone knows the answer right now. What I worry about is that we have right now a very hard right majority. Kennedy is resigning, and I don't want to see another hard right justice replace him. And that has everything to do with the issue of pre-existing conditions, whether we maintain the provision that protects people from insurance companies denying coverage to people who are very sick. It has everything to do with women's health and a dozen other issues.
Before we let you go, a lot of your supporters want you to run for president again. A lot of Democrats, though, are still angry, believing you hurt the party in 2016. Senator Sanders, will you run in 2020?
Well, it's a little bit early to be talking about 2020 right now. Absolutely, and that's why I'm going to Kansas, is my focus on 2018.
That's Senator Bernie Sanders, an independent from Vermont. Senator, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And Senator Sanders is speaking tomorrow evening in Kansas City, Kansas, at a rally for Democrat Brent Welder, who is running in the Democratic primary to face Kevin Yoder in Kansas' 3rd Congressional District. Earlier this week, we learned about the young women on the front lines of school desegregation. You can hear their stories at kcur.org/up-to-date. You can find us on Twitter. We're at @KCURUpToDate, and I'm at @PTSBrian. Also, follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow on the program, join us. We'll talk about why some folks up in Clay County are asking the state to audit their county government. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. I'm Brian Ellison. And you are up to date.